From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
From the halls of the World Economic Forum to the streets of New York and Munich to the Social Forum in Porto Alegre, is another world possible?
I'm Amy Goodman with Aniruddha Das for this second hour of our two-hour special, Protests on the Streets. Welcome to Democracy Now! Is Another World Possible? This is the latest headlines. The Justice Department has directed the White House staff to preserve records of contacts between government officials and Enron executives over the last 3 years. The request comes in the wake of revelations that both Enron and its auditing firm, Arthur Andersen, destroyed vital documents related to the company's collapse. It's the first sign that federal prosecutors have extended their criminal investigation to the White House. Administration officials vowed to comply with the request, but played down its political implications, pointedly noting that it covered a period that started before President Bush came to Washington. Still, the request foreshadows the likelihood that some of the documents will be sought by criminal investigators and, as such, could pose a political problem for the administration. The Bush administration has so far refused to turn over government records to Congress. Meanwhile, it's also emerged that the former head of Enron, Ken Lay, gave the White House a list of his personal recommendations for key federal energy posts. Two of the people on his list were appointed, providing the strongest evidence so far of the political influence wielded by President Bush's biggest financial backer. A White House spokesperson said Thursday that Lay gave the list of names to Clay Johnson, Bush's personnel director. Among the eight or so names were Pat Wood, now chair of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and Nora Brownell, a member of the commission. Ken Lay was supposed to be one of the guests at this year's World Economic Forum, but Enron's record-breaking corporate bankruptcy may find the corporation thrown from the WEF membership. He was listed on the annual meeting participation list as intending to attend. Argentina was thrown into fresh chaos this weekend when its Supreme Court declared emergency financial controls imposed by the government to be unconstitutional. The decision significantly raises the prospect that the country's banks will collapse. The central bank said it's declaring Monday and Tuesday bank holidays to stop Argentines from withdrawing their deposits en masse and toppling the largely foreign-owned banking system. Many of these banks are now considering pulling out of the country entirely. The unexpected Supreme Court ruling threw the government into disarray, causing it to postpone announcing a new economic plan. It also prompted Argentina's economy minister to cancel his planned visit to the World Economic Forum today. And in the first official reaction to Bush's State of the Union address on Tuesday, the North Korean government today has condemned the speech, saying it's little short of declaring a war. It said, however, it's powerfully equipped to handle any conflict. In his address, Bush labeled North Korea, Iran, and Iraq an axis of evil, and said North Korea is building weapons of mass destruction while letting its people starve. He warned the three nations could become targets of a so-called war on terrorism unless they end support for groups that he called extremists and curtail the proliferation of nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons. Meanwhile, the North Korean state media said U.S. warplanes had carried out scores of reconnaissance flights in recent weeks in preparation for an attack. Israeli helicopters carried out a missile strike against a Palestinian naval base in the Gaza Strip before dawn today, calling it retaliation for mortars and gunfire directed at a Jewish settlement. Meanwhile, thousands of Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank rallied in support of Yasser Arafat, who's been held under virtual house arrest in Ramallah for the past 2 months. The rally comes a day after more than 100 Israeli army reservists signed a statement saying they would refuse to serve in the West Bank and Gaza because Israel's policies were involved dominating, expelling, starving, and humiliating an entire population. The campaign has so unsettled the military command that the Army's chief of staff suggested today that the objectors are inciting a rebellion. And in Munich, thousands of people are protesting the NATO meetings that are taking place there. You're listening to Democracy Now!
people are rising up. It is a global movement.
For justice.
For democracy, for social justice, and freedom.
For the right to protect our environment.
February 2nd, the movement is rising in New York City.
So bring your friends. Another world is possible.
Giving you. Make your own media. Independent media.
Then one fine morning she puts on a New York station. You know she don't believe what she heard at all.
That produced by the Independent Media Center of New York, and it's wonderful to be broadcasting on WBAI in New York, as well as KPFK in Los Angeles, all the community radio stations around the country, as well as public access stations. This two-hour special is Another World Possible, broadcasting from the streets of New York, the protests of the World Economic Forum, as well as Porto Alegre, Brazil. I'm Amy Goodman with Aniruddha Das.
It's wonderful to be here, Amy, and having this joint broadcast playing things from the Independent Media Center really underscores what we can do so well, where the mainstream media are focusing only on violence, threats of violence, and now that there is no violence, they don't have a story to talk about. What we will bring you is what we would always have brought you, which is a critical, thoughtful analysis of the humane vision, the alternative vision that people have brought and are going to bring through the rest of the hour.
Aniruddha, we're going to go to the streets of Porto Alegre, where we have gotten incredible video via the internet from Rick Rowley of Big Noise Films, Chris Abrams and Deepa Fernandez, who are producing for us from Porto Alegre. And maybe you can introduce, there are three interviews, but the first woman who speaks is a key figure in India.
Medha Patkar, the first woman in the first segment that you see, has been very critical in as a public figure around many of the economic and social justice movements in India. People here are familiar with the movements around the growth around the use of big dams, the Narmada project, which is going to displace many hundreds of thousands of people. People here are also familiar, obviously, with Enron. She has been a focus of much of the activity, really directing the spotlight of criticism on these and their destructive effects.
Enron has become a household name in the last weeks because of its collapse, the largest corporate bankruptcy in U.S. history. But it was well known before that in India.
Starting from 1992, Enron has really come to encapsulate all that is bad, all that is destructive in this, the policies that we see linked to the World Economic Forum in terms of its destruction of the environment, its destruction of its impoverishment of a state, and the human rights abuses, all of these really having real costs on real people, much more than just a little bit some financial shenanigans in the boardroom.
It took over the electricity production for an entire state of India?
It was supposed to, at that time, in 1992, India was under a lot of pressure to liberalize its economy. And one of the things it did was to open up its electricity sector. So it was brought in to supposedly provide electricity. Well, the state of Maharashtra, which is a state in which Bombay is the capital, really needed maybe 1 or 2 hours of peak demand. Instead, Enron came in on a contract to take over 22 hours, producing at 14 times the cost. It got the government of Maharashtra to subsidize it to the tune of 1/3 of the entire state economy. and it got the government of India to subsidize it.
And the U.S. ambassador at the time became an Enron official?
The U.S. ambassador, Frank Wisner, went on record more than 700 times pressing Indian government to accede to Enron's demands. Well, not surprisingly, once he finished, he became a board member of one of the Enron companies, a director of one of the Enron companies.
We're going to go now to the streets of Porto Alegre. Maria Luisa Mendonça will be the last person you hear. She is one of the major organizers of the World Social Summit. Before that, Ananya Bhattatarji, who is with the Veach Foundation. But first, Mehta Pakhtar, who is with the Save Narmada Dam movement, the National Alliance of People's Movements in India. To the streets of Porto Alegre.
In India, we are fighting the neoliberal policies because it has impact on all the downtrodden sections. The indigenous communities that are in the various river valleys are already getting displaced over the last 53 years. But now with the globalization, liberalization, since the agenda is privatization of not just energy and power generation, but also water, their lands and water and everything is being taken away. And the development, so-called, is on the fast track. So we are fighting WTO because now the centers of power have moved on to the global centers. They are no more within the nation state boundaries. So we have to be a part of the global action and global forum as we see it.
Mehta, what do you hope to get out of this World Social Forum? What do you hope to take back with you?
You see, as a part of the Save Narmada movement and also the National Alliance of People's Movements, we've always felt that it's necessary to have a multiple fora strategy, and that really ranges from the village to the WTO. So within India, the National Alliance of People's Movements, my organization, has also joined hands with certain of the political parties to form a very unique alliance. Now, knowing very well that all parties, wherever they are in power, have a common agenda, we feel that we must make them committed to people and commitment to fight WTO. And beyond WTO, the globalization as a whole is very essential. So similarly, the alliance amongst the people's movements at the global level is a must. So beyond the national alliance, we feel that this kind of alliance and forum would bring out the maximum common denominator in terms of our conceptual frameworks, the framework of analyzing the present neoliberal policies on one hand, and also the framework for the alternative development paradigm on the other. Basically, to find out what is the common agenda and also to work out the common strategies, because I think there is a need to overhaul our strategies, which should go beyond just sit-ins and rallies. We must be able to have a face-to-face confrontation. So I want to see whether that comes out of this.
Mehta, what's the situation like now for your people in India post-September 11, with the militarization right around the border, with the increasing tensions with Pakistan? How is it there right now?
See, both Laden and Bush as terrorists are not liked by the common people anywhere in the world, I must tell you that. People are not for violence, they are for peace, whether or not they are a part and parcel of the peace movement or not. They want to relate to their neighbors, whether they are the neighboring states or the neighbors within their own small section of society. So in India, although the communalism again is taken to its peak, and that's because the rightist government is in power and it tries to instigate people. And with this 11th September tragedy, it was. Because one would not like anyone to resort to violence, whether it is Osama or Saddam Hussein or whosoever. But then there is a reaction to the American hegemony, which is bound to come up, that they must realize also. And if it is violence when thousands of people at the World Trade Center are killed, we mourn and we really feel the battle for peace is lost from time to time. But we also mourn for the children in Iraq who died as a result of the wrong or the exploitative and terrorist policies. So the state terrorism also is to be fought, and that will be fought by the common people themselves.
Mehta, do you have a message for all the people who are on the streets in New York City right now protesting the World Economic Forum, being surrounded by police when they're marching along peacefully like this? What's your message for them?
march and march ahead, because ultimately the violent state and the corporate power doesn't know how to fight the non-violent people's movement. So if not today, tomorrow, we are going to win. It's not just Enron that has collapsed, you know, but even these kind of empty structures which are trying to change our cultures and not just adjust the structures, as I believe it, are not sustainable in themselves, you know. So they may use our own language and co-opt us, try and co-opt us, but they cannot do that with millions of people all over the world. And the people who are for right to life and livelihood will join the students who are mobilized in a large scale on the streets of New York. And since they are the youngsters, I think it is going to be an intergenerational fight. And so the movement will be sustainable and not these so-called gigantic powers.
I'm Ananya Bhattacharya, and I'm with the Funders Network on Trade and Globalization. And we have also come with a lot of community-based organizations in the United States who are organizing in communities of color. And the whole point is to show that the anti-globalization movement in the United States is composed of groups that are grassroots, that are working in poor communities and communities of color. And these are not just policy groups in Washington, D.C., but these are real communities.
Ananya, what lessons will you learn from today, from seeing all of this around you, that you can take back with you to the United States?
Well, I think this is a very unusual place, because I'm hardly in my hotel room, but I happened to be there for a minute and I switched on CNN and I saw them calling these protesters in New York terrorists and talking about how New York cops are everywhere. And just after that, I joined the march here. And it's amazing to find hardly any police here. And it's just such an open atmosphere. I think this is just an incredible place. I've never, coming from New York, where police officers try to outnumber protesters, this is an incredible feeling.
Mendoza, who is in the organizing committee of this amazing event that's happening around us. Maísa, can you tell us a little bit about what went into the organizing of this event? Talk us through what got us to here today at the opening ceremony.
Well, actually, this is the work of literally thousands of volunteers. We have a very small office with six people, and other than that, we have about 3,000 volunteers and organizing hundreds of conferences, workshops. We have 700 workshops, over 100 seminars, and another 30 conferences plus film festivals, theater festivals, music concerts, and also events on the streets, such as the march today. The first idea came right after Seattle, because we realized that there was so many interesting things happening in Seattle, and the media focused mainly on an isolated case of violence and police violence. So we felt the need to show that this international movement has concrete experience that need to be shared. And the World Social Forum is a space for people to show that, yes, we are working on concrete alternatives. So to give visibility and also to bring people from the north to the south, because another problem we had is that our government sometimes say that the movements in the north are protecting the interests of their own government. So it's important for us to show that we are united, the movements in the north and in the south. So organizing this in Porto Alegre was a symbolic move in this process that started before us. And it started with a few people sitting on a table, five people talking about this idea, but because we feel that we are part of a process that is much bigger than us, we got so many people involved, and now I think that this event is organized, and it's only possible because literally thousands and thousands of people and organizations are organizing it.
Maísa Mendonça is one of the organizers of the Porto Alegre Forum in Brazil, the World Social Forum, as we move back and forth between Brazil and New York on this day of protest, as well as organizing the idea of imagining a different world. Is Another World Possible is the name of this two-hour special. We'll be back in a minute.
They say everything can be replaced. They say every distance is not near. So I remember every face of every man who put me here.
Nina Simone, I Shall Be Released. Here on Is Another World Possible? I'm Amy Goodman with Anuruddha Das.
Thank you very much, Amy. The costs of international economy, the costs of globalization have real costs on real people. And we will be talking about it in just a second with Aaron Goldzimmer. Aaron is an analyst and writer at the Environmental Defense Fund. Very happy to have you here, Aaron.
Thank you, Anuruddha.
Aaron has recently produced a report talking about the effects of export credit agencies, which seems to be something, it's a financial agency, it is something that people's eyes glaze over when you hear about it. But these international financial agencies have effects, again, which have real damages on people's lives. We talked very briefly earlier about Enron in India. Well, not only was Enron very corrupt, not only did it make land grabs and try to grab the resources of the entire government of India, people who were protesting it or trying to find out about it were beaten by the police, Indian police, who were being paid by Enron. For example, the police paid by Enron using Enron helicopters broke down the doors and windows of the house of one of the major protesters, dragged the wife of this protester, dragged her out from her bathroom naked out onto the streets, beating her with batons. She was at that point 3 months pregnant. Well, the dark secret is that much of this activity is actually funded by U.S. taxpayers. People have this image of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund as the groups that fund development projects in third world countries. But actually, there are banks, part of the U.S. governmental structure, which do it. Aaron?
You're right, Anuruddha. Really, export credit agencies have to be seen as in the same class as the World Bank, IMF, WTO, WEF, these other economic structures that people are concerned about. It's sort of, I view it as a pantheon of corporate-led globalization that really people are increasingly becoming concerned about. And as you said, a great deal of attention has been paid to the domestic implications of Enron's collapse and also some attention on this plant in India, only because of the administration's efforts to pressure the Indian government on Enron's behalf. But what most people don't know is that there's another unknown Enron partnership that people haven't been told about, and that's a partnership with you and me. We, as taxpayers, were major investors in this plant in India that led to incredible, massive human rights abuses and violations, as well as 12 to 18 other projects throughout the developing world. $2.3 billion worth of financing was provided by you and me, American taxpayers, to Enron through these export credit agencies.
Talk about how these export credit agencies function, what their names are. And I should say, Aaron is one of hundreds of people who are in New York, not only protesting in the streets, and this gets very little attention since the whole focus of the corporate media is, will there be violence? They're not talking about police riots, but they're talking about violence on the part of the protesters. It's almost becoming a joke now. Now that they haven't seen this violence, they are asking protesters in the street, well, how, you know, talk about your behavior. And they'll say, well, we're very happy, we're penned in here, the police are over there. And that's the end of it. You have no idea why they are in the streets. But you have been participating in forums over the last few days. There are forums in Los Angeles, in Munich, as well as protests on the streets there, certainly in Porto Alegre. You were speaking at the Church Center in the last few days about this issue?
Absolutely.
This is across the street from the United Nations.
Absolutely correct. All of the media attention that I've seen has been focused on the protest with very little reference to what the protests are about, and certainly no accurate reference. We've been holding a conference in the United Nations Church Center that's been very well attended. And yes, I was speaking on this issue of export credit agencies and trying to discuss and raise people's consciousness about the implications, social, environmental, human rights implications of these major international economic structures.
How much of the economic structure, how much of the funding for development comes from these export credit agencies?
The figures are hard to believe. Most people the mind boggles. People see the World Bank as sort of the major player in these kinds of development projects, large infrastructure or resource extraction projects in the third world or developing countries. Actually, the World Bank has been doing less and less of this sort of thing. The total World Bank funding annually is around $20 billion a year. Part of that goes to structural adjustment and other kinds of activities. It's a few billion dollars a year.
So a couple of billion dollars from the World Bank. And in contrast, these credit agencies?
Our best figures are about $55 billion a year going to this kind of major project finance in developing countries. So the World Bank, it's very important to note that the World Bank does finance some incredibly awful projects, and often export credit agencies and the World Bank work hand in hand co-financing the very same projects.
But an important difference is that the World Bank actually has a mandate, supposedly, to fund projects which are for the improvement and development of these third world or underdeveloped countries where it is investing. It is true, all the critics on the left have criticized the World Bank for not following its mandate. The difference with the export credit agencies is that they do not even have this mandate. Their only mandate is to make money.
That's absolutely the case. I mean, this is really a question of from bad to worse, because you have the World Bank, which, I mean, its supposed theoretical goal is to alleviate poverty and contribute to development. We all know that it's in very important cases not doing that. But export credit agencies, their purpose has nothing to do with development, has nothing to do with social benefit. Their purpose, their reason for existence is promoting northern country exports and foreign investment.
And it has, of course, not only coming through northern countries, but typically it comes into countries like China and India. One of the other major examples is the Three Gorges Project.
Exactly. A lot of people are familiar with the Three Gorges Dam. It will cost $24 billion, although I've seen estimates that it'll cost close to $100 billion. It will create massive public health risks because all of the residential and industrial waste from one of the most heavily populated areas in the world flows untreated into the Yangtze River. Once you stop that up with a dam, it's going to create a public health and pollution nightmare, cause incredible silting problems. Some experts have estimated that there's a 1 in 1,000 chance of a dam break. And again, in one of the most heavily populated areas in the world, that could lead to tens of millions of deaths.
And again, we want to emphasize that these are things which are really being funded by us as U.S. taxpayers. It is our money which is underwriting the loans. Many of these loans, because these loans are given without the oversight of a group with even a mandate for development, so the loans are often very bad loans, are pocketed by corrupt officials, and it is finally we who are underwriting these destructive effects in all of these other countries, these development projects.
That's exactly right. And again, it's a good point of comparison to go back to the World Bank, because the World Bank actually rejected the Three Gorges Dam. It told China sort of discreetly not even to bother asking it for financing. The World Bank also rejected this Indian power plant that we were discussing, this Enron plant in India. It said it was too large, it was too expensive, and the terms were overly generous to Enron. But export credit agencies have stepped right in. In the case of Three Gorges, the World Bank said no, but export credit agencies, beginning with the export credit agencies of Germany and Canada, stepped in with hundreds of millions of dollars of financing for the Three Gorges Dam.
And there is, however, a growing, albeit very small, but growing understanding of this, of the implications of this, and there have been some opposition to this internationally as well as nationally.
People only really started tracking on this issue and the incredible role of export credit agencies in the international economy. Mind you, export credit agencies back nearly $1 out of $8 of all world trade. So when you talk about globalization, it's not a process that's just sort of a natural process result of technological improvements and that sort of thing. Governments, we as taxpayers, are backing financially nearly $1 out of $8 of all of these increasing trade and capital movements.
Much of which, of course, has no oversight, no sort of critique, and no public body for public welfare looking over its outcome. Thank you very much, Aaron Goldzimmer. Aaron has been talking about these issues at many other forums across the city, in the public eye on Davos, in the Church Center, at the UN.
And just before you go, Aaron, just to understand, and we're going to go to the streets, we understand tens of thousands of people are now outside the Waldorf as the different groups and marches converge in one place. The connection between these export agencies and the World Economic Forum that these protesters are outside in the freezing weather protesting.
Well, the World Economic Forum, as we all have said, is just a private club consisting of the richest corporations in the world. And export credit agencies are governmental public agencies that subsidize those corporations when they do their exports abroad and their investments in developing countries. So this is the public mechanism for absorbing the risks of these corporate investors.
Well, I want to thank you, Aaron Goldzimmer, again, of the Environmental Defense Fund. You can go to their website at edf.org.
Thanks.
As we go now to the streets, Kristen Scher is on the line with us. Kristen, what's happening?
We've got between 10 and 30,000 people, those are the estimates, on the southeast corner of Central Park, penned in by several hundred police. It's a really colorful march. Black Bloc is here, puppets are here, the samba bands are here, the tango dancers are here. It's really active. People are milling around, getting ready to start going. So far, I haven't heard of any arrests in this particular space.
This police strategy of putting people into pens and rotating people, did you count on this?
I'm sorry, what was that?
The police strategy of rotating people into pens. Did you count on this?
We expected that we'd be put in pens because that's what the police usually do at any rally. So far, people seem to be respecting those boundaries, actually, and not stepping out of them. We'll see what happens next, though.
Well, thank you very much, Kristen Scher. As we turn now, staying in the streets, to Jari Labau, who is with the Inang Bayan movement in the Philippines. Welcome to Democracy Now!'s Is Another World Possible?
Hi, good afternoon.
It's good to have you with us. Can you tell us why you've come to, well, the area outside the Waldorf Astoria? Why are you and your movement, the Inang Bayan, protesting?
We are here to support the rest of the people who are protesting the World Economic Forum, because the Philippines is part of this thing. The Philippines is one of the countries that's going to be badly affected by the policies that are being implemented, and all the results of this forum are going to affect the Philippines greatly. And because we are all here to protest the war, which is greatly linked with globalization issues. Like right now, the Bush administration is expanding the war against terrorism, and we believe that the Philippines is going to be the next target. The U.S. government just recently deployed 660 military troops in the Philippines. This is in response to a hostage situation that occurred in the Philippines, but this is a very remote situation, and we believe that that the U.S. government and the Philippine government is using this as an excuse to have the American military presence back in the Philippines.
Well, we're going to go right now actually down to Porto Alegre to continue this discussion on the issue of the U.S. military presence in the Philippines with more than 600 U.S. soldiers going there. I want to thank you very much, Inang Bayan, movement representative, joining us now from the streets of New York, Jari Labau. We're going to turn to Walden Bello. We just spoke with him by video phone. He's at the World Social Forum in Porto Alegre about this very issue of the U.S. militarization of the Philippines. Walden Bello is a well-known activist, executive director of Focus on the Global South, and professor of sociology and public administration at the University of the Philippines.
Well, this is a really very dangerous escalation of the American war. They are sending 600 U.S. special forces, ostensibly to train Filipino troops, but they're actually going to be in the combat zone. And basically, these people will be in a situation where they will probably come under fire. And once they come under fire, then, as we all know, the response of Washington to such situations is to, as they say, respond in kind. So what we see is that this is really a dangerous escalation. They're planning to send about 2,000 more people there. This is such a sham. The sort of reasons they're using, they're saying that these are legitimate training exercises, but we all know that these are really efforts to directly intervene in combat. This is very dangerous because, as we all know, they're going to be inserted in an ongoing insurgency. While the Abu Sayyaf group is might be considered a very questionable group in terms of its tactics, and by it definitely is a group that most of us would repudiate the sort of tactics that it has. Nevertheless, it is a group that does have a mass base in the Moro and Islamic community in the Philippines. And what the U.S. troops are going to do is that they will actually move and intervene in a process of what has become a communal civil war in the Philippines in the last few years. What we have been telling both our government and the United States all along is that you cannot solve this situation with force. The roots of terrorism are in poverty, in inequality, in national oppression. Those have to be addressed. Coming in, violating the sovereignty of our country, and using force, we can guarantee that that would fail. It will create tremendous civilian casualties. It will draw more people into active resistance, and it is going to create a tremendous mess in the southern Philippines. So my own view about this is that this dangerous escalation is bound to fail. Unfortunately, it will create a tremendous social and political dislocations in that part of our country. However, I think we should note that There is a growing anti-war movement in the Philippines, an anti-interventionist movement. It was born, a formal coalition was born about 4 or 5 days ago, and that it's an uphill battle, but I think we're quite confident that we will get those U.S. troops out of the Philippines. I think this is a situation that the United States thinks that it can get away with the pure application of force here. I think that the United States will realize that people will be defending their sovereignty, and that they will encounter a fierce and growing nationalist movement in the Philippines. The Philippines is not Afghanistan. This is a country that in which you have a situation of insurgency that has been going on. It's a very complex situation, and my sense is that the simplistic solution that the U.S. has here simply is not going to work.
Walden, that was Walden Bello speaking to us from Porto Alegre, Brazil, at the World Social Forum, talking about the 600 soldiers that are now moving into the Philippines, 600 U.S. soldiers, as the war is expanded, the so-called war on terrorism. You're listening to Democracy Now! Special Is Another World Possible. When we come back, we go to the streets of Munich. We'll go back down to Porto Alegre, to Los Angeles, to a forum there. Michael Parenti is about to speak, and back to the streets of New York. Stay with us.
Oh, oppression, you prey on us when we sleep. Oppression, you chase after the tired, the poor, the weak. Oppression, you know you mean only harm. Oppression, you reach out with your long arm. But oppression, let you near me. Ah, oh, no. Oppression, you shall learn to fear me. Yes, you will. Oppression, you seek population control. Oppression, to divide and to conquer is your goal. Oppression, I swear that hatred is your home. Oppression, you just won't leave bad enough alone, but oppression.
Ben Harper, Oppression, here on Democracy Now!'s Is Another World Possible? As we broadcast from the streets of Brazil, Porto Alegre in New York, the protests of the World Economic Forum. I'm Amy Goodman with Aniruddha Das. Aniruddha.
Even here, as thousands of the world's richest business and government leaders meet in the hallowed halls of the World Economic Forum, the Munich Security Conference, a NATO organization, is meeting in Munich, as they have every year in February, a meeting of administrative officials and about 200 representatives of military strategists, generals, and experts on military equipment of NATO. We now go to the streets of Munich, of protests on this issue.
That's right. And Patrick Beckett, who is a reporter for Free Speech Radio News, interviews a protester who preferred not to be identified.
So you just talked to the police for a long time. What did they ask you, and you know, what did you talk about?
Well, they were asking us where we're from and what we wanted to do, and then we said we're from Berlin, and they said they asked us what we're doing, and we said we're tourists, and they didn't believe us, and they probably suggest or think that we are radical, violent, aggressive autonoms because we live in Berlin. And then they told us that we are not allowed to stay on that place, on the Marienplatz, for till tomorrow at 12 o'clock. And they said we aren't allowed to stay because the demonstration and the press conference is not allowed, so we are not allowed to stay.
But did they give you any specific reason why? They asked you to leave because we can see that there's many of these tourists walking around the square.
Well, they said we look like people who are active and who might be aggressive and violent in demonstration.
So no evidence at all. They just looked at you and told you because of the way you looked, you need to leave the square.
Yeah. And earlier they checked our bags and they found a jacket I had in there. And the first question they asked was if there is a hut on it, because, well, I guess that they have a stereotype of autonomous and aggressive people, and I guess too that within the police they tell the police people that all the autonomous look in a certain way, and yeah, so.
How many have you been controlled, once or more than once?
Well, from yesterday, about, I don't know, six times maybe.
And each time they check, and then you are let to, you can go?
Each time they check the our identities, and twice or three times they checked our bags.
So can I ask you what you think about the police presence and whether or not like they are overreacting and, you know?
Well, the police presence is very strong, and I think that the police presence always, not only here but in all the other places, also causes aggressions on the sides of the demonstrators. And what I really think is really, really dangerous that they forbid the that we don't have the right to speak. I don't know if you heard about the action yesterday, how they passed out white papers and the police confiscated the white papers and the white sheets because they forbid to any kind of political speech or any kind of political saying. So, and that's a basic law, and they totally canceled that, and I think that's really, really dangerous, and I don't know where the borders are and how far they won't go.
And that was a protester in the streets of Munich, Germany, interviewed by Patrick Beckett when she talked about autonoms. I think that's the German word for anarchist. You are listening to Democracy Now!'s two-hour special, Is Another World Possible? As we go now down from Munich to Porto Alegre once again, these two major events taking place in New York, the World Economic Forum, in Porto Alegre, the World Social Forum. Tens of thousands of people are there. We're going to turn now to Raj Patel, who's with the group Focus on the Global South from Zimbabwe. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello there, Amy.
It's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm here with Aniruddha Das, co-host of this special.
Hello, Raj. One of the reasons you are there is to talk about the new Economic Partnership for African Development, or NEPAD. And could you say something about NEPAD and how it would affect your country, Zimbabwe?
Well, the New Economic Partnership for African Development, NEPAD for short, is sort of a FTAA for Africa. It's it's been couched in a veneer of promoting human rights and people-centered democracy, but also, interestingly, in the in the prelude to it, it does make very strong commitments to making the market safe and reliable. And really, you know, to make the market safe and reliable means to entrench the rights of investors and the rights of capital, and for those rights to trump the rights of people. So what this means effectively is that investors will be able to plunder Africa and be able to siphon yet more money out of Zimbabwe. I mean, and clearly the people, I mean, the person who's been promoting NEPAD has been Thabo Mbeki, together with Obasanjo from Nigeria. But both of them clearly seem to have forgotten the lessons of history, because everywhere that in Africa that an economy has opened up to foreign investors, systematically the economy has been plundered and money has been siphoned out. And there's no reason to suspect that NEPAD will be any different. So it's not looking good, and this is one of the battles that we're going to have to fight here and that we're mobilizing against.
Now, one of the terrible legacies of colonialism, which has remained even in these independent African countries, is the legacy of suspicions, mutual suspicions between the African original inhabitants and Asians who were brought over largely by the British or other colonial forces to rule the countries for them. Unfortunately, some of these suspicions also seem to spill over into interactions between the different Asian and African caucuses.
Well, yes, that's right. I mean, the British policy of divide and rule is sedimented into both African and Asian history. There's not exactly mutual suspicion, but there's a certain willful ignorance about between the Asia and Africa caucuses here. I mean, it's important to remember that Porto Alegre, for all the celebration that's going on here, I mean, we are creatures of our time, and so we're trying to build another world, but we're not there yet. And one of the things that we're trying to do here is build bridges between Africa and Asia, and try to sort of basically remove the blockages that colonial history has put down that separate us. So we're fighting to end racism in the South by, for example, the Asian group yesterday drafted a women's statement against militarism, pointing out that in all conflict it's women who bear the brunt of the attack. And this is something that both Africa and Asia, Asian organizations, feel that they can sign on to. And this is one of the ways that we're trying to bring the activists from the two continents closer together.
Well, Raj Patel, I want to thank you very much for being with us, a focus on the Global South, speaking to us from Porto Alegre, though he is from Zimbabwe. Hundreds or tens of thousands of people in the Brazilian city for this multi-day event, talking about an alternative to the World Economic Forum that's taking place at the Waldorf Astoria today in Midtown Manhattan, surrounded by police barricades and bomb-sniffing dogs. The thousands of peaceful protesters have converged outside the Waldorf Astoria. We're, though, going to go now to Los Angeles, because I think what we could say is going on right now is a kind of global teach-in. It's happening all over the world, from protests to teach-ins. Michael Parenti is about to give a speech at Fairfax High School in Los Angeles, along with a number of other people, on the issue of militarism and globalism. He joins us now. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Michael.
Hello, Amy.
It's great to have you with us, author, social activist, political analyst. As we go take this global tour today, can you talk about the connections between globalization, the World Economic Forum, and the kinds of issues that you're discussing?
We definitely are. Hello, I'm getting a terrible echo here. Getting my own voice in, Amy. Can you clear that up?
We're just trying to get the levels right. If you could just ignore it. Ignore that man behind the curtain.
Yeah.
Are you there? We're going to try to get Michael Parenti back on the line with us right now. But as we finish up this tour, Anuruddha Das, you have been working on these issues for many years. Enron, a classic example of what we're seeing, the kinds of protests on the street, the largest corporate bankruptcy in history. On Monday, there will be congressional hearings that are taking place, very much a symbol of all that the people are in the streets are there for.
It is true, Amy, that even though that much of the focus on Enron in this country, even focus from the left, has been purely on financial issues. In a magazine like The Nation, they say, quote, crime in the suits, failure of market orthodoxy. But it is much more than a failure of market orthodoxy. It is really a failure in India, which was about to impoverish 65 million people, the entire one-third of the entire state budget of Maharashtra, which is the richest state in the country, which is the economic engine of the country, 25% of the country's economy. One-third of its entire state budget was to be sucked into Enron. The entire Enron, through its contract, got the government of India to promise that the government of India would pay Enron, would release its rights to every single object that the government of India owned, everything save its military and its diplomatic enclaves abroad, everything that it currently owned and that it was to own in the future would be hypothecated, that is set aside for Enron to use in case Enron found it necessary at any time in the future. These are the sorts of destructive forces that companies like
Enron... And the U.S. government role that facilitated Enron's entrance into India?
Not only did it facilitated in, I must say, a bipartisan manner. It started in 1992. During at the time of Clinton's presidency, Ron Brown, as Secretary of Commerce, would bring Ken Lay on his private plane to India to push his case. All through that period, Frank Wisner, who was the ambassador, the U.S. ambassador, spoke about Enron 700 times. Richard Celeste, who was the next ambassador, gave India a serious talking to when he was leaving, for not pushing Enron's case sufficiently. All of these situations were really pushed. And now, of course, we have knowledge about Dick Cheney coming in as VP.
Well, we are going to end this program back on the streets of New York. Michael Parenti, we will play his speech that he gives at Fairfax Hotel. We'll just consider the little conversation with him a tease. But Brad Simpson, who is a former Democracy Now! Producer, is out on the streets. Brad, can you give us a final snapshot of what's taking place right now in New York City outside the Waldorf Astoria?
Well, Amy, I'm marching down 60th Avenue. I guess there's about 20,000 people out here. It's a pretty inspiring scene. There's thousands and thousands of activists representing every branch of the social justice movement. There's environmental activists, anti-corporate globalization activists, anti-war activists, all mobilizing under the idea that another world is possible. There was a brilliant kind of puppet pad to kind of reclaim the streets for those who are working for social justice, and we're actually marching right in front of an 80-foot puppet, a dragon that is attempting to gobble up injustice right behind us, so it should probably get out of the way. But I'd estimate there's about 20,000 people. I can't see the end of the march in either direction.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Brad Simpson, as we go out on the streets of New York City. And Aruda, thanks for being with us. Democracy Now!, produced by Chris Abrams and Deepa Fernandez in Porto Alegre, Brazil, by Miranda Kennedy and Lizzie Ratner in New York City. I want to thank all the listeners around the country who've made this broadcast possible. If you'd like to email us, you can go to mail@democracynow.org, and you can go to our website at www.democracynow.org. We'd very much like to hear from you, and we'll continue our series, Is Another World Possible, on Monday, as we continue on the streets of New York, on the streets of Porto Alegre, Brazil, going to Munich and around the world. I'm Amy Goodman with Anuruddha Das. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!
Because the world is round, it turns me on. Because the sky